clearance.
Last show about being winter, and it's winter here in Northern California. It's raining. It's raining cats and dogs, as you might think, or as I will say. And I love the rain. When I was a kid, I used to go out and stamp in with my little boots, stamp in puddles. And a lot of my friends today think I'm nuts. I like to go out hiking in the rain, and so. It's been raining pretty hard, and I went out for a hike the other day. It's funny because it seems like a lot of the little critters, salamanders and slugs and lizards come out, and I'm always amazed that when I'm on a path, there's literally tons of lizards, tons of little critters running around just to get some fresh water. It's funny, but I love to hike. I get up there locally, and I'll hike the local hills in the mud. I got my mud shoes on, and it's invigorating. And of course, there's nobody else out there, so I really find it's God. I want to get my shoes on right now. It's coming down pretty good here in Northern California, San Francisco Bay Area is where I'm located. For those of you who want to know, so. Anyhow, I hope you're doing well. Hope it's a good day for you. Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia. Remember, Gaia is promoting their 99-cent special. It's a good one for the holidays. 99 cents gives you access to their complete streaming media catalog. And these are fantastic series from people like Graham Hancock and Dave Wilcock, lots of people. Greg Braden's going to be introducing a new series, I think, at the end of this month that will be promoted heavily in January. But you can see it all. Check it out for 99 cents. It's your first month. And if you're an Earth Ancients listener, you can get this special right now. Go to Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. And there's a special page that's been created for us. On that website. So check it out. When you check them out, they help us. So check it out. Hey, make sure you're going to the website too, earthancients.com. I'm just started a monthly newsletter, and the newsletter will cover what we have talked about on the program, a lot of news items. And the other thing I'm going to start doing is I get free ebooks from a number of publishers. Every month I'm going to try to have an ebook there. I haven't announced the ebook for December because I'm looking around to see what's most fitting. But register. Go to earthancients.com and scroll down to the bottom and get your name on there, because I'm going to be giving away books, and you want to get the newsletter every month because it has tons of good stuff in there. And attached to the newsletter, like I was just saying, is going to be this free ebook. So it's something you don't want to miss. Earthancients.com. On the Facebook page, early this morning, I posted a really cool flyover. It's a drone flyover of the Cholula Pyramid in Mexico. And we've talked about the Cholula Pyramid. The largest pyramid in the Americas. It's a monster. And it, for some reason, it was covered up thousands and thousands of years ago when Cortez landed. The natives who were in the area said that it had been around for thousands of years before they arrived. So the civilization that built it, we don't know who it is, but it's a monster. So this flyover shows, actually it goes, this drone goes very, very high. It goes up over the top of the mountain, which on top now sits a Catholic church. But it comes down and it shows what is exposed of the pyramid. And a lot of details that you don't typically see from the ground, and areas of the pyramid that are not typically photographed. So that's on the Facebook page. Earth Ancients, go to Facebook, Earth Ancients group, and check that out. Always go to the Facebook page because there is a ton of really great photos. Each week after this program, I post notes from the show, and it's a really good place to kind of check a follow-up after you've listened. As an example, there's a great series of quite unique photographs from Dr. Mark Carlotto, who was the guest last week on the Ruins of Mars program. And kidding, these photographs, they look like buildings. I mean, they are so angular, it's ridiculous. And for them to be hundreds of thousands or millions of years is quite astonishing. But it's obvious to my eye and to his that these are artificial. So check it out. It's on the Earth Ancients Facebook page. Go to the group. And actually, he's actually put in there, what do you get? Oh, six photographs. Some of them look like regular building foundations. It's pretty cool. I want to look at that. Hey, as a reminder, this is the month to get the discount for the tour next April, Path of the Sacred Maya, April 2nd through the 8th. We're going to be checking out the pyramids and the other Mayan ruins in Yucatan, Mexico. And if you register this month, you can get $600 off the fee. $600. It's $400, and then if you register for December, it's an extra $200. And I'm only taking 20 people. And this is a chance to see these ruins up close and personal. I mean, this is a way to climb some of these pyramids, to actually see how they were constructed, and to experience a really, really ancient place that I have enjoyed for over a decade now. I used to go every other month or every other year. But now I haven't been down there in about 5 years, so this is going to be great. And next week, we're going to have one of our guides, the Mexican shaman, Miguel Angel, will talk a little bit about the importance of ceremony in some of these sites, as well as maybe some of the energetics that he senses and what he's been told about those locations. So you can read all about it. My website, go to earthancients.com. You'll see the big banner, Path of the Sacred Maya. When you click it, I have the entire itinerary on there. Be one of the 20. Actually, there's only like 10 left. Be one of the 10 that are left and come and join us. April 2nd through the 8th, 2017. It's going to be a blast. It's so much fun down there. You can't believe it. I mean, if you live in the United States, you have got to go to Yucatan because it's truly an ancient place. And to my mind and how I feel about it is, it's really the relics, true link to the ancient past, because that's a pyramid culture, and that's a whole different mindset. A lot of subtle energy, earthbound energies coming up through those places, and you're bathed in it. When you're there, you're like, wow, it's amazing. You actually feel it. So today we are talking about ancient Egyptian monuments. A great deal has been discussed about that. And it's unfortunate that we have to have a history of ancient monuments dictated to us by a group of so-called scientists known as Egyptologists. I mean, people like Zahi Hawass, who is supposed to be the foremost authority on pyramids and Egyptian culture. I mean, he even in the face of evidence showing that these monuments are significantly older, he refuses to believe it. As an example, John West, Dr. Robert Schock, revealed that the Sphinx is significantly older by the weathering in the body of the Sphinx and by the outer enclosure. I think Schock believes it's 10,000 years old. John West believes it's 20 or up to 50,000 years or older. And even with that evidence, he is not willing to budge. Zahi's an interesting guy. I actually met him a couple of times, one time in New York and out here in California. He's very entertaining, but it's just somebody who's really hard to deal with because he doesn't see any other point of view. We have him here. Zahi, how are you? Oh, by the way, you have a new book, don't you?
My new book is The Magic of the Pyramids. I'm talking about the discoveries that I made at the pyramids, like tombs of the pyramid builders, and also about building the pyramid, how the Great Pyramid was built, about the Sphinx. Are there any tunnels under the Sphinx? It is a book that has magic and mystery.
Well, that's interesting.
We are going to send the robot in year 2016 to reveal the secrets behind the doors that I found inside the Great Pyramid. And will be the year that will reveal the secrets of the Pyramid of Khufu. The Pyramids of Egypt has nothing to do with the pyramid in South America or Mexico or anything. All the pyramid shape all over the world were built as tombs, but no connections between them and the Egyptian pyramids that dated back 4,600 years ago. I would like people to come, because Egypt needs tourists. Because tourists, when they come to Egypt, they pay for the restoration of the Egyptian monuments. And this is why we need tourists to come back. And Egypt is safe. And Egypt is very friendly.
Egypt is safe. And Egypt is very friendly. I would like to go. I just heard this morning that there was a bomb that exploded on the close to the pyramids, killing 6 police officers. So, Zahi, I don't really know if Egypt is safe right now. It's unfortunately not true. But anyhow, that it was taken from another interview earlier this year, introducing his new book, Magic of Pyramids. I don't have it. I'm not really interested in it because I don't think he's an original thinker. I have a real problem with him. In fact, late last year, he was invited by Graham Hancock to speak on his opinion. And unfortunately, things got kind of ugly.
This man is a genius and a good old doctor. And who wants to do pretty much
in academics,
he's not an academic.
In academic world, we do not do ad hominem arguments. We do not debate the lab.
Yes, sir.
We debate the lab.
The matter is debated rich and closed.
No, it's not.
It is debated closed. It's closed.
And that's Zahi yelling at Graham Hancock because he discovered that Robert Vival would be calling in via Skype during the presentation. And Zahi is very uncomfortable with Robert Vival because Robert Vival has called him out on a lot of his distorted views and lies. And basically, Zahi called him a criminal for a number of different reasons. So Zahi Hawass isn't somebody I really appreciate. And I think that he does history a great disservice. And it's unfortunately the fact that he is considered the top Egyptologist in the world and represents our, you know, our history and gives us our history according to him. So there's actually some American universities that do pipe in occasionally, but unfortunately he is the spokesperson. But that's a negative. Those were negative. Today we have a returning friend. Scott is coming to us. Scott Creedon is a Scottish author. He has a new book called The Great Pyramid Hoax, The Conspiracy to Conceal the True History of Ancient Egypt. And it's a wonderful book. Scott, how are you doing today?
Hi there, Cliff. It's good to talk to you again. That's been, I think, probably 2 or 3 years since I last spoke to you. I'm doing good.
I think it was 2014. I think one of our first programs. Hey, we got a little echo. Do you have? Are you listening in? Can you turn that down? So.
I'm not quite sure why. How is that?
Let's say hello.
Hello.
It's still a little echoey. So we'll hang in there and see if we can work with it. This new book is quite interesting. You spent a great deal of time in that first book, Secret Chamber of Osiris, and actually looked inside the Great Pyramid and were gave us a real interesting perspective on not only what you believed the pyramid was built for, but also gave us kind of an understanding that the actual pyramid was quite significantly old. What is it about this new book? What got you going with this pyramid hoax and Vice's look and comments about the pyramid that are now historic?
Okay. Well, I hope you can. I hope you can hear me clear enough.
Yeah, you sound good. Just a little echo in the back, but we'll work with it.
Okay. Well, I think for me, when I was writing the previous book, The Secret Chamber of Osiris, Lost Knowledge of the 16 Pyramids, I came across a logical problem in the dating that I gave in that book for the pyramids. My own view is that the pyramids at Giza are somewhere in the order of about 19,000 years old. And as you know, I present in the previous book evidence to support that dating of the pyramids at Giza. Now, obviously, that presented a problem because inside the Great Pyramid in 1837, an English aristocrat, a chap called Richard William Howard Vyse, he found some hidden chambers. These are small, they're called relieving or stress relieving chambers above the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. Now, these chambers, they're about the same dimension as the King's Chamber, although they're only about, each one's only about a few feet high. And there's about five of these chambers above the King's Chamber. And in these chambers, this chap, Howard Vyse, discovered some ancient writing, some ancient text written in a primitive red ochre paint. Now, among these texts that Howard Vyse discovered was some cartouches, which is basically the name of the king is always contained within a cartouche. And these cartouches that he found, he had to blast his way using gunpowder into these chambers, Cliff. So these texts, according to the story related back by Howard Vyse and his published volumes, these red-painted marks, quarry marks, he called them, are genuine. And so if we find, according to Weiss, so if these marks are genuine and the Khufu cartouche that he found in these chambers are genuine, then that presents a problem for my dating of the previous book, because Egyptologists have dated Khufu, the pharaoh Khufu, to 2500 BC.
Right.
So
right.
If that's only 4,500 years ago. So how can the pyramids be 4,500, nearly 19,000 years old if we have this evidence which shows that they're actually only 4,500 years old according to mainstream Egyptology? So that was the start of the quest for me in investigating these marks, because I totally, utterly rejected that dating because of the evidence that I had found and presented in the previous book, which showed that these structures are 19,000 years old. And that, I think, is a similar date to which John Anthony West goes for as well.
Robert Schock, too, right. Before we get into Colonel Howard Weiss, I want to ask you a couple questions, because we want to refresh our listeners' mind. First question is, how did Weiss get permission to blast into the pyramid, or was it such a time where he just picked somebody and he blasted into the pyramid? Because I saw a photo of what he did. It's pretty ugly.
Yeah, the gunpowder archaeology. I think the answer to that, Cliff, is back in the early 19th century, we're talking about 1837. The regulations, excavation permits weren't as strict or as tight as what they would be nowadays. So that basically is the answer to your question. People begin and do pretty much what they wanted inside these chambers.
It sounds like there wasn't much law or much restrictions as there is today in terms of getting in there and saying, look, I want to look inside there. And so the guy would blow out a whole section of the Great Pyramid. And then actually, not just the outer area, he blew in a whole corridor, didn't he?
Yeah, he basically cut a channel, a vertical shaft above the king's chamber. This shaft probably goes to about, 30 feet, 30 or 40 feet. And he blasted that with gunpowder. Goodness knows what could have happened, with the king's chamber, with, the roof of the king's chamber, with the roofs of all these other chambers above the king's chamber, had something gone wrong, catastrophically wrong, with what they were doing. But it was just, these were the early days of, rediscovery of our ancient Egyptian heritage, Cliff. Only about 15 years earlier, Champollion, the Frenchman, had cracked the hieroglyphic code and had begun to decipher the hieroglyphic text. That was only about 15 years before Weiss went to Egypt, so it was a very early stage in our rediscovery of this ancient heritage of mankind.
Yeah. Wanted to ask you about that, because I know that you had researched and actually looked at Weiss's notes, his field notes and his actual personal diary. And I just find it interesting that he would be so violent with this huge a pyramid and then just blow it to the smithereens without really any because who was he representing? The British government? Or was just because he had a few he was a very wealthy person, he just said, here's whatever money you need and I'm going to do what I want. What was his motivation?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say, that it all kind of goes to his motivation, and that's a fairly complex question. There's no definitive answer on that. What we do know, Cliff, is that Howard Weiss was very much a military man. He was very much a martinet, a strict disciplinarian. He was a very humorless man. In his previous existence, we know that he was the type of character that would do whatever he needed to do to get what he wanted. And he was very determined, a very determined man. We know from his published journals, he published three books, and we know from these books that he was determined to find something important in these pyramids. Mm. What you also have to understand as well, at this time in 1837, you know, there was national prestige at stake for these countries like France, Germany, Italy, Britain. You know, there was real international prestige at stake. You know, Italy and France and Germany were finding these amazing artifacts, were making these incredible discoveries at the time. And Britain, you know, our explorers were finding nothing. You know, so there was national pride at stake. I think that that probably goes to part of the answer to that particular question. You know, so Weiss, you know, it was almost as if the pressure was building for him to find something major. And he was really, you see in his books, Cliff, you see in his books that he was absolutely determined to find the real burial chamber of Khufu. He talks about this in his books. Mm. He never did find it because it was never there in the first place, because there weren't tombs, in my opinion. I explained that in the previous book. But, you know, nevertheless, Weiss was determined. He believed that this was a tomb, and he was determined to find the actual remains of Khufu in one of these hidden chambers that he was blasting his way into. He was utterly determined, a military man, and didn't care what got in his way to do this. You can tell this by his previous actions in the United Kingdom Parliament, where he, during the election of 1807 in the UK, he basically bribed his way to power, to win a seat in the UK Parliament. He spent something like £3,000, which was an awful lot of money back then, you know, to buy his way into the British Parliament. And one of the candidates that stood in that election against Weiss complained to the British Parliament about, you know, Weiss's practices in that election.
Yeah. Yeah. He actually showed evidence of the cheating too, didn't he? He actually showed a lot of detail. He showed evidence of the cheating and the.
As I say, I present that in the new book, The Great Pyramid Hoax. That evidence is all there. So the guy was a cheat. The guy was a fraud, you know, in his nature. And the guy was the type of guy who did what was needed to be done to get what he wanted to achieve his goal. He was basically ruthless.
Let's talk about Weiss. Colonel Richard William Howard Weiss was raised by a wealthy family. Obviously, he was schooled, but and you just talked a little bit about his background. But he and his exploratory team are credited for discovering these quarry marks. And this is the contention. This is what he has used to actually date this pyramid to Khufu and Cheops and Khufu, same thing, which gives it a date which today is used by Orthodox Egyptologists. Let's tell us a little bit about these quarry marks.
Okay. Well,
and where they're located to, Scott, because that's really important.
Okay, right. The quarry marks. Now, there are five chambers above the king's chamber. Remember, the pyramid is basically, there's nothing, there's no writing whatsoever in any of the early old kingdom pyramids. Absolutely nothing. They're anonymous. These marks were the first writing anyone had ever found in these pyramids. The very first writing. Up to then, these pyramids had been anonymous, completely anonymous. Now, it was believed in Weiss's time that the pyramids were tombs, and there was some belief that the Great Pyramid was built by Sufis or Khufu or Cheops. They're all the same person, apparently. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. So there was a belief, and that belief stemmed from Herodotus, who, writing about 2,000 years or 2,500 years ago, basically said that Cheops, Khufu, built the Great Pyramid. That's what Herodotus said. And Herodotus was writing about 2,000 years after the Great Pyramid was built. So where Herodotus got his information from, we will never know. But anyway, these marks, now, these five chambers, the very first chamber, it's called Davidson's Chamber, named after the British attaché to Egypt in the late 17th century, a chap called Davidson. Now, he discovered the very first chamber, the one directly above the King's Chamber, and inside that chamber there's absolutely nothing. No marks, just like the King's Chamber, just like the rest of the pyramid, there are no marks whatsoever. Now, it's a chap called Giovanni Caviglia, who actually lived in that chamber while he was doing some explorations of the Great Pyramid. He lived in this small chamber, Davidson's Chamber, while he was doing his explorations. And he suspected that there were other chambers above it. What he did was he pushed a reed of straw through a crack above his head in this small chamber. And it went on and on and on and on. And he suspected there's another chamber above this. And he told Howard Weiss this. There's a bit of contention about who made this discovery. Caviglia claims he made it, and Weiss contradicts Caviglia, and Weiss claims it for himself. So there's a real question about who actually made that discovery. Personally, I suspect it was Caviglia. But anyway, there was no marks in Davidson's chamber. Now, Weiss opened up, eventually using gunpowder, blasted his way into the chamber above Davidson's, which he named Wellington's Chamber, after the Duke of Wellington.
Okay.
And now, here's the thing, a small detour here, Cliff. He, in his private notes, his private handwritten notes, which I managed to track down to a small library down in London, Weiss writes in his private notes, and this is, he'd inspected this chamber on two occasions, and he writes in his private notes, not his published book, his private notes, that there were red marks in this chamber, but nothing like hieroglyphics. Nothing like hieroglyphics, okay? You know, so then what we find later in the British Museum is that this, remember, Weiss was determined to find a cartouche because a cartouche would help him date the pyramid. That's what he says in his published book. Right. We find in the British Museum today there is a cartouche being painted by one of his assistants from that chamber, which Weiss in his private journal said there was nothing, there was no hieroglyphics there. You know, so we have these contradictions. And then in his published book, he says, oh, on this night, we found the quarry marks. He doesn't even say he found a cartouche, which was the very thing he was looking for, cartouche.
Okay.
You know, because finding the cartouche would help them date the pyramids. Now, the thing about these marks, the big thing about these marks is because they have these cartouches, it allows Egyptologists to date the pyramid because they were locked in, they were sealed from the day the pyramid was built. And they are basically the holy grail of Egyptology, these red-painted hieratic quarry marks. They're the holy grail of Egyptology because without these marks, the provenance of the Great Pyramid would have been still a guess in their estimation. It would still have been a guess. They knew what Herodotus had said, but there was no real proof. There was no hard physical evidence that Khufu did build this structure. So, with these marks, they go, ka-ching, we've got it, as Dr. Mark Lenner, the famous American Egyptologist, said in his book, The Complete Pyramids. These marks were the clincher for the Egyptologists. It gave the Egyptologists the definitive proof that Khufu built the Great Pyramid. And that's the importance, the real importance of these marks. So to then, for me, investigating these marks and finding all this contradictory evidence about Weiss's discovery of them, it just throws, you know, a big, big question mark over this discovery about these marks. Are they genuine or are they not?
Yeah.
Well, if you go through the book, which you obviously have, Cliff, there is a ton of evidence in this new book of mine which shows, no, these marks are fake. They are absolutely fake. This is a fraud. This is a hoax perpetrated against the world by this guy in 1837.
Okay. Let me just ask you, just to clarify for our audience. So basically, Egyptologists look at this identification, and I guess it's a partial marking or a cartouche that says something about Khufu, and then there's some quarry marks, and that's basically what Weiss found, and that's where he was saying that's where the world now thinks that the Great Pyramid was built by Khufu.
Yeah, that's pretty much it in a nutshell, Cliff. But there's these quarry marks are in four of these chambers. There's a whole raft of these quarry marks. It's not just one Khufu. There's about one Khufu cartouche. There's about, I think, six or seven different cartouches throughout these chambers. One of them is Khufu, and one is Khufu's full name, which is Khnum Khuf. So there's about five or six Khnum Khuf versions of his name, cartouches, and there's one Khufu in the very topmost chamber, which is called Campbell's Chamber. But as I said, there's for all these cartouches, and these cartouches form part of a name of the what Egyptologists believe they form part of a name of the gangs that built the pyramids. This is how they say that these marks were built, were painted by the gangs at the quarries. That's why they're called quarry marks, because they allegedly were painted by the gangs at the quarries, given their gang name, and their gang name included the variants of Khufu's name, and there's three different variants of Khufu's name that we find. An ancient Egyptian king could have five different names, and in the Great Pyramid we find three of the names of Khufu, on various walls and the various upper stress relieving chambers.
Is it your belief that Weiss forged all of the cartouches that are in that area, or is he just he and then maybe his assistants forged or added those cartouches that are up there? What do you say? What do you say about that?
Yeah, if you in the book, the evidence seems pretty clear to me, Cliff, that Weiss absolutely knew what was going on. Now, I've said just a few moments ago that I found Weiss's private journal in this small museum down in London. And when you read through his private handwritten notes, you know, in his handwritten notes, he says he didn't find anything in this chamber, and then a cartouche appears from it by Mr. Hill. But in other chambers, he's actually written an instruction of where he actually wants his assistants, Hill and Raven, to place the Khufu cartouche in Campbell's chamber. He basically
You're
tells
kidding
them,
me.
No, it's you know it's there in his handwritten notes. It's obviously it's not in his published book. Why would he put something like that in his published book? But he's writing in his private notes and his private thoughts where he wants this cartouche to be placed. And it's a note to his two assistants, Mr. Raven and Mr. Hill, where to place the Khufu cartouche.
Now, is it your understanding that he would be this malicious? I mean, that's a huge thing that he would do. It's not only a hoax. It's manipulating history.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, Cliff, the more and more I discovered evidence that proved this happened, the more I found myself becoming angry, really angry about this.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, we have been cheated from our history by these people doing this thing.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, I don't know if Weiss was acting on his own in doing this or whether he was funded by some other organization, because I know that Champollion, who cracked the hieroglyphics, when he went to Egypt, he made one visit to Egypt, Cliff, and that visit by Champollion to Egypt was funded by the church. But the church would only fund Champollion's trip to Egypt on one proviso, that he did not release any information which may undermine the teachings of the church. And this, I think, is possibly one of Weiss's reasons for doing this, because Weiss also was a very, very religious man. Now, that may sound like a contradiction that he would then go and do something like this. But no, when you actually see to Weiss, Weiss probably didn't see he was doing anything wrong. Mm-hmm. He was merely confirming what he believed was already taken for granted at that time. But more than that, what I think he was trying to do was to ensure that the pyramids would be dated within the provenance of God's creation, according to Weiss's religious beliefs. Weiss believed in the deluge. He believed in the creation date of 4000 BC, which Bishop Usher of Ireland came up or calculated 4000 BC is when the creation happened. Yeah. Weiss had to find a cartouche that fitted in before that date, and he did. And thus,
so you're
he has made sure.
Actually suggesting that this is premeditated for him to get into the pyramid and to apply these cartouches so that the pyramid would be dated according to the current thought about the history of the world.
I think to some degree it probably was premeditated to some degree. I can't say exactly how much, and I can't say exactly, you know, was Weiss funded out with his own expedition to do this? Because, you know, what you have to understand is Weiss spent £10,000, Great British pounds, on his explorations. In 1837, Cliff, that would be worth, in today's terms, that would be worth £1 million. You know,
I was going
to
say,
that's a lot of money to find nothing. You know, that's a lot of money. Somebody, and I know Weiss was a wealthy, wealthy man. You know, he had big estates in Britain. He was distantly related to the royal family here. You know, so he wasn't in this for the money. I think possibly he was in it for prestige, for notoriety, and also I think part of the big motivation possibly was religious reasons as well, to ensure that the Great Pyramid fell within, you know, the provenance of God's creation.
Timetable, yeah.
Timetable. Yeah. I go into that in quite some detail in the book.
You do. The book, again, is The Great Pyramid Hoax for you listening, and it will be out, I guess it's coming out this next week. It's going to be available via Amazon on the 15th, that's the release date. So you can get a copy. I just took a look at it online. They're going to release it on the 15th. You're not the first one to talk about this, Scott. And in your book, and I didn't realize this until I found out, and I actually have a copy. Zachariah Sitchin brings this up in great detail in his book, Stairway to Heaven, which was written in 1980, where he actually makes the same claim that Weiss forged these marks in the cartouche and also various king names. Now, what happened when he brought this up back in 1980, Scott? What was the reaction from the Egyptological Society?
Right. Okay. You're absolutely correct. Zechariah Sitchin brought that up, this particular issue, up in his first book in 1980, Stairway to Heaven, and in his later book, 2007 book, Journeys to the Mythical Past. Now, in his 1980 book, Sitchin depended on work that was done in Wilkinson's book. He's a British, an early British Egyptologist. And the problem was that Wilkins' book wasn't printed very clearly. This was the problem. And Zechariah Sitchin hadn't actually visited the chambers. They tried to get into these chambers of the Great Pyramid to actually see these cartouches for himself, but he never actually managed it. So he never actually got to see these marks, and he was basing his argument on the very badly printed marks in Wilkinson's early book. And he was basically saying that Wilkinson's book had a dot for the king in the circle. One of the characters was a circle with a dot in the centre where it should have been lines. And that was a big part of Sitchin's argument. But the problem is, Wilkinson, I mean, you see later versions of Wilkinson's book and, you know, other authors at the time, you can see that the lines, the dot was actually just a bad print. The ink and the lines had basically smudged probably together, and it just became a blur. So it wasn't a dot, it was actually lines. So that, in a sense, blew a big hole in Zechariah Sitchin's argument, plus the fact that he didn't actually go and see these marks. He didn't even, he couldn't even have seen a photograph of the actual cartouche, because it talks about expecting the lines in the circle to be diagonal. And when he went to see Mr. Hill's drawings of them in the British Museum, they weren't diagonal. But Sitchin had based that argument on an artefact, the inventory stela, I believe it was, which apparently showed these lines to be diagonal. But, you know, if Sitchin had understood ancient Egyptian writing of this Khufu cartouche, he should have known that the Khufu cartouche can be written, that this circle could have been written in the cartouche with one line, with two lines, three lines, diagonal lines, straight lines, or even just blank. And according to Egyptologists, that is all equally valid spellings of Khufu. Even a plain circle with nothing inside it, which most scholars or readers of ancient Egyptian texts would think would be the sun god Ra, but no, in the context of Khufu's name, it's actually K-H. It's pronounced the same way as we would say Loch in Scotland. You know, it's Khufu, this symbol, this circle with nothing inside the circle. So Sitchin basically messed that up, that part of his argument up. But the point is, though, Sitchin presented other evidence which is still valid to this day, like Davidson's chamber. Why is there nothing in there? Why are there no marks in Davidson's chamber? Why do we find marks only in those chambers that Weiss himself and his assistants opened? Nothing in Davidson's. Also, Sitchin, in his later book, Journeys to the Mythical Past, he presented this absolutely amazing piece of evidence from a guy called Walter Allen, who lives in, or who rather lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he passed away in 2007, unfortunately. But Walter Allen was a ham radio enthusiast. And he was discussing with his family elders in 1954 his roots. He was also a very keen amateur genealogist. Mm-hmm. And he was discussing with his family elders, you know, the history of the family and grandfathers, great-grandfathers, and so forth and so on. And it was explained to him by some family elders that his great-grandfather, a chap called Humphreys Brewer, worked with Howard Weiss at the pyramids. And his great-grandfather, Walter Allen's great-grandfather, Humphreys Brewer, witnessed Howard Weiss's two assistants, Mr. Raven and Mr. Hill, painting forged marks inside the Great Pyramid. And this is written down in this piece of text, this family history, which was totally unconnected to Zechariah Sitchin. This was written in 1954, and it didn't come to light until 2007. You know, it was just this piece of family history. You know, Walter Allen read Sitchin's books and realised that there was a connection, that, you know, he read about the forgery theory that Sitchin had written about in his first book.
Oh, interesting.
And realised that what he had all that time was proof that what Sitchin was writing about was correct, because his own great-grandfather had witnessed it. this pottery taking place. So we've got all this in the book as well.
Is it your belief that all the cartouches that are in that space are fake, or are any of them possibly written after the pyramid was built by Egyptian rulers?
No, they're absolutely, in my opinion, Cliff, they're all fake, every single last one of them. And I explain why they're all fake. I give all the different pieces of evidence for each one of those cartouches and piece of text in the book,
okay.
And I show exactly why they are all fake, every last one of them.
Now, Graham Hancock and Robert Bevall have both had things to say about this chamber. And I know in your book you do have a section where you actually corresponded with Graham to get his opinion. But isn't there a situation recently where Robert Bevall was accused of harboring a German student who took a scratching of one of these cartouches to measure or to get us an idea, analyze it to see what the date or the age was?
Yeah, this happened, I think it was April 2013, Cliff. A couple of German students, well, they're actually degreed students from a university in Germany, went to the Great Pyramid, and they had permission to go into these chambers. It's uncertain whether they actually had permission to take any samples. It's pretty doubtful that they did. But they nevertheless took a small sample of paint from a fairly insignificant sign. Now, they're all important, but there's been a big, big muddle in the press about this, Cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Khufu cartouche destroyed by German students. That's absolute nonsense. They didn't touch the cartouche at all. Absolutely did not go near the cartouche of Khufu in those chambers. They found a small, fairly insignificant mark elsewhere in the chamber, in a corner of the chamber, and they took a small sample of paint from that fairly insignificant sign to have it tested, radiocarbon dated, because what they did in ancient times with this ochre paint was sometimes they would put fish oil or honey or gum inside the paint to act as a binding agent for the red ochre mix, so that when they applied it wouldn't just run all over the wall. You know, so this was a binding agent, and these are obviously organic material. They can be radiocarbon dated. So this was the hope. This was what they were trying to achieve, because obviously, you know, they're trying to find out if this paint is original, then it will tell us roughly how old the pyramid actually really is.
Exactly.
That was the hope.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they didn't have enough of a sample for radiocarbon dating to occur, they just didn't have enough of a sample for it to go ahead. But they did did provide other chemical analysis, which they sent to myself. I spoke to Dr. Dominic Gerlitz, and he sent me the information about the chemical analysis that the German laboratory undertook on their sample, and that analysis gave a whole lot of other information which allowed me to determine once again and to discover more proof that, you know, those marks are fake. They're absolutely fake, given this scientific analysis that has been made.
Do you think that Egyptological community will recognize what you've written?
Whoa, that's a question. To be honest, Cliff, I actually think, and I'll explain why in a moment or two, but I actually think that the Egyptological societies, you know, the establishment, you know, the academic community, they probably already know they're fake. Because if you look at the Khufu cartouche, what you were talking earlier about Robert Bavall and the German students,
yeah.
What happened was Bavall investigated this, and he got a whole series of photographs over time, I think from about 2003 to maybe about 2006 or 7. Mm-hmm. And over that span of time, you can see small pieces of paint disappearing from outside the actual Khufu cartouche. This is before the German students, long before the German students, incidentally. Okay, so you can see small notches of paint being taken or being removed. And I think possibly the ancient or the Egyptian authorities have taken pieces of this ancient paint and had it analysed, and they know the truth themselves. And I believe they do, because I have a very good friend who is an Egyptologist, and when I sent them my first book, my previous book, The Secret Chamber of Osiris, to have them review it for me before, obviously, it went to the publishers, they wrote back and said to me, well, you know, Scott, the chapter you've got in there about vice and the fraud, you know what? Most of us Egyptologists know it's a fraud.
You're kidding me.
No. And if anybody ever, I can't say who this Egyptologist is, but if it ever goes, if it ever becomes, difficult or official, or I will give the information if I am asked. I may or may not, but I'll see. But this Egyptologist friend of mine said, we know they're fake, but we cannot say that they're fake. If we said they're fake, there goes my research grant to Egypt for the however long. You know, so it's
God,
it's so
I hate
difficult
to hear that kind of stuff. That just makes me
so
sick to hear that.
Yeah. But this is, I mean, and this wasn't myself coming, you know, from the alternative camp, so to speak, saying this is what happened. This was someone actually in the academic side saying this is what would happen. You know, so this Egyptologist friend said to me, well, we know their fate. But when you go through the book, Cliff, as I said earlier, there's a ton of evidence in there. You know, we've got everything from the orientation of these marks, which is wrong. We've got the distribution of the marks, which raises big questions. We've got the orthography of the marks, you know, the specific chronological evolution of these hieratic marks presents all sorts of problems. You know, we've got the eyewitness accounts, we've got the evidence from Vice's private journal, the evidence from Hill's, Mr. Hill's facsimiles, the chemical analysis. You know, we've got high-resolution photographs which shows so much issues with these particular marks. It's a wonder, really, when you read this book, that anyone nowadays could think that these marks are actually genuine.
You know, that the community would know this. Respond is fascinating to me. And it just makes you wonder about what other things they know about that they're keeping quiet just in the interest of not rocking the boat. I want you to consider what I'm going to say here. I want you to give me what your opinion is. Let's say that it comes out that Vice's description is a forgery, that he did hoax the whole thing, and that the governing body of Egyptology takes your claim and says, okay, we agree, that's a forged cartouche. What would be the outcome of this kind of disclosure? What do you think would happen?
Okay, well, first of all, I think it's probably highly doubtful that they would ever engage in a transparent scientific survey of these marks. You know, I would desperately love, Cliff, for History Channel or Discovery Channel or one of these channels to take this evidence and to go, right, you know, get it out there, get it out in the open, because this book itself isn't going to ruffle any feathers with the authorities back in Egypt. You know, I personally think they'll just ignore it, because if they ignore it, that way they'll think it will go away. You know, mm-hmm. that's the, probably the best way. Just ignore it, and then it'll go away, and very few people will get to hear about it. The thing is, the more people that get to hear about this, the bigger the outcry will be, and that will force Egyptology's hand, you know, to actually do something about this and to actually, you know, do a proper scientific analysis of these marks, because that's all basically I'm hoping for. You know, I presented all this evidence to say, well, look, here's a ton of evidence that says these marks are fake. But does that prove they're fake? Well, to some people it probably does. To a lot of people it probably won't. It's a fairly subjective thing. But what we need is an open and transparent analysis, scientific, deep, you know, scientific analysis, forensic analysis of these marks to get to the actual truth, where we can say definitively, yes, they are fake. If it comes out that they are, what will that do? Well, for me, I view these marks as a barrier to the truth.
Yeah.
You know, these marks, as Mark Lehner has said, are the clincher. This is their hard piece of evidence that, you know, shuts down the debate. And it has been pretty much shut down for almost 200 years. Yes, they're tombs. We absolutely know these structures are tombs because we found Khufu, and Khufu was a king, and these kings built pyramid tombs. So this is his tomb.
Yeah.
You know, so it shut that debate down. Now, if it turns out that these marks really are fake and we get to the absolute definitive truth on that, then it removes that barrier. It allows us to, you know, take a fresh view on these structures. Why were they built? Now, I go into that in my previous book, and I present, again, a whole load of evidence to support my view that they absolutely are not tombs. They never were built as tombs, conceived as tombs ever.
Yeah.
They may well have been used as tombs, repurposed as tombs, by much later dynasties who found a very old structure, and they may have appropriated them as tombs. I'm not denying that that may well have happened, but they were never conceived as tombs.
You know, I have to agree with you that it's it makes you angry. It makes me angry and sad that these people that are charged with describing and presenting our history would allow this falsehood to be perpetuated. And the evidence that you've brought forth, as well as some early researchers, is pretty damning. And for Vice to have done this, and for Egyptologists to know that these marks are fake, and yet they use it, and it's written in our history books that the Great Pyramid is around 4,000 years old, is shameful. And it has to be those of us who are independent research investigators to bring this up and throw it in the face. And you saw, excuse me, you heard Zahi Hawass getting upset with Graham Hancock before I introduced you, when he mentioned that Robert Bivol would be presented in the talk. And I just find that a lot of these historical events presented to us are on very shaky ground. And this book, The Great Pyramid Hoax, is a wonderful read. But before I let you go, I'd like you to talk a little bit about your belief about what the true date and purpose of the pyramid was, Scott. And I know you said in the beginning that, and I read this in your earlier books, that you believe that the pyramid was built around 19,000 years ago. Who do you believe was the race that built the Great Pyramid?
Okay. Well, if you consider the writings at the Temple of Horus at Edfu cliff. On the walls of that temple, the pillars and pylons of that temple are written ancient texts, which have come to be known to us as the building texts. And basically it tells of the ancient Egyptian civilization, you know, how old it was and where it came from. It talks about how the ancient Egyptian civilization started in, they were an island nation, and in the primeval times, that island nation sank beneath the waves. Now, I know there's echoes there of Atlantis, but that text, that story is written on the walls of the temple of Horus at Edfu. And when you count up all the ancient kings written onto that, the walls of that temple, the dynasties, the ages that they add up to are almost 40,000 years. Now, Egyptologists say, well, that's all just mythical. These are mythical kings, from a mythical age. You know, but hey, wait a minute. What if they're not? What if they're actually...
yeah.
What if they're actually... What if it's actually true? And mankind's history, as we have been taught it, is just wrong. You know, that, you know, you think about it, Cliff. We have been around Homo sapiens sapiens. Our physiology, our modern physiology, has been around for about 190,000 years. So 190,000 years to what? Just 4,500 years ago. What were we doing all that time? We were just sitting around the campfire waiting for someone to invent the television or X Factor or something. What were we doing? You know, we can't have been sitting around all that time doing nothing. You know, so I believe that, you know, we weren't, that our civilization goes back much further. You know, look, we found Göbekli Tepe, you know, a temple there in Turkey, Anatolia in Turkey, that is 12,000 years old. We weren't supposed to be doing anything like that 6,000 years ago, never mind 12,000 years ago. You know, so we're pushing the boundaries of discovery of ourselves further and further back in time. And I believe eventually, because remember, 19,000 years ago, the world was a very, very different place, Cliff. A very different place. Yeah. Because back then, you know, right across North America and Europe, all across the continent of Europe, there was ice sheets that were 2 mile thick. 2 mile thick ice sheets. Now they, for some reason, 19,000 years ago, began melting. We don't know why, but something happened and they started to melt, and that meant more water getting into the seas. That meant coastlines around the world disappeared to what eventually we have today. Now, strange that the ancient Egyptians, one of the texts that have come down from the ancient Egyptians, talks of a time when the king's astronomers were observing the skies and the stars were moving in different ways from what they would normally move. The stars were behaving erratic, were behaving different, as was the sun, as was the moon. You know, and the king, King Saurid, at that time, you know, we're talking ancient times here, but this has been preserved and come down to us. You don't hear a lot of it in most standard Egyptian textbooks. But nevertheless, it's there, it's been preserved, and it comes down to it. And I'm basically looking at these texts and saying, well, wait a minute, what if there is actually more to these texts? What, when this king, Saurid, asked his astronomer priest, what does this mean? The priest said, it means in 300 years will be a great flood, and it will destroy the entire kingdom. The king's instruction then was that they would build pyramids across the land, and to store in these pyramids everything that the kingdom would need to resurrect itself, to make itself reborn again after the worst excesses of the flood, the deluge, had passed. That was what he decided to do. That was his instruction, his instruction for these pyramids to be built. These pyramids would hold everything that the kingdom needed in each of the chambers. And there was a lot, there were 16 of these pyramids that they built or completed. Now, they would put in them seeds, every seed you can imagine. They would put in them tools, they would put in them you know, vessels of all kinds, pots and so forth. They would, you know, they would put in, build in their knowledge. You know, it would be a storage place for their knowledge. You know, they put everything in these pyramid structures so that the kingdom could be reborn. That's why, you know, this idea that the pyramids were some kind of revivification machine, a recovery machine. The Egyptologists tell us, yes, it was a recovery machine for the king. I say, no, you've got it wrong. It was a recovery system for the kingdom originally. Later, as the pyramids became religious icons, the king adopted that idea into the Assyrian religion, and it became a recovery machine for the king's soul. Because originally, that's what the pyramids did. They were the recovery system for the kingdom. Not unlike, Cliff, what we're actually doing ourselves in the Arctic Circle. You've probably heard of the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, which opened in 2008. Our civilization has done the very same thing the ancient Egyptians have done. We have opened this seed vault and put every seed imaginable from all over the world in that seed vault. And if you actually look at the Svalbard seed vault, there's three main chambers with this big, long tunnel connecting them. And if you look at the Great Pyramid, there's these three chambers with this big, long tunnel connecting them. You know, the parallels are just incredible. And if you look at the Step Pyramid at Saqqara, that's the first pyramid the ancient Egyptians built, the very first giant pyramid ever built. In the early 20th century, a British explorer called Firth, went down into the passageways under that pyramid. He was walking through passageways up to his shins, his knees, just below his knees, in barley and wheat, all sorts
really?
Of types of
really? I never read that. Which pyramid was that again? I'm sorry.
This was in the early 1900s, the Step Pyramid at Saqqara. Not only that, but they found that inside, there's umpteen galleries and magazines underneath this pyramid. At Saqqara, the Step Pyramid. And when he entered these galleries, he found something in the order of 40,000 storage pots with, you know, seeds and also, you know. This is what I'm saying. There's a recovery system for the kingdom. And this is what the ancient Egyptians tell us it was. You know, they were anticipating a massive flood. And the other amazing thing, Cliff, 16 pyramids they built as their recovery system. That's what they built. Now, if you plot the location of these pyramids onto Google Maps, what you find, and I showed this in the previous book, you're probably familiar with the ancient Egyptian god Osiris with his three-pronged Atef crown and his arms crossed with the crook and flail. And that's the classic iconographic figure of Osiris. Now, when you plot the pyramids on the ground, you know, along the banks of the Nile, you find when you join them, you know, dot to dot, you join these dots, they make an outline, a matchstick figure of the god Osiris. And this is what the pyramid texts from the 5th dynasty, they found these small texts engraved in these much smaller pyramids, not the old giant pyramids, much smaller pyramids. They talk about Osiris being the grain. They talk about Osiris being the pyramid. Osiris is the pyramid. Osiris is the grain. That's what these texts, these religious texts, the very first, our oldest religious texts from anywhere in the world, they talk about Osiris being the pyramid. Because it's true. That's exactly. And he is the god, ancient Egyptian god of rebirth, of regeneration, of agriculture. That's why, you know, Osiris became, you know, this particular god figure, because quite literally these 16 pyramids form the shape of Osiris. And in these texts, these pyramid texts, they give us the creation story. They also tell us about the story of Isis and Osiris and how Osiris's evil brother, Seth, was jealous of Osiris being the king, and he cut Osiris' body into 16 pieces and scattered it along the banks of the Nile. Now, this is just an allegorical tale to tell us, you know, that Osiris is in 16 parts. His body has been scattered along the banks of the Nile. You know, so this is the hidden you know, knowledge that you won't find in the conventional. You'll find the Osiris myth. You know, you'll find that in the books. You'll find the creation myth in the books. But the thing is, they're all standalone little entities. Nobody has ever joined these pieces of text up into a complete single narrative story in the way that I have done in my books. You know, they talk about the Egyptologists talk about, oh, but we've got the main piece of evidence is the granite box in the burial chamber. Well, how do you know it's a burial chamber? It's a burial chamber just because you label it a burial chamber. But how do you actually know it was a burial chamber? Well, because you call it a burial chamber? No, that doesn't make it a burial chamber, just calling it that. Well, the sarcophagus.
You're talking about the box in the grand gallery of the Great Pyramid, right?
Yeah, in the king's chamber of the
king's
Great Pyramid.
King's
now,
chamber.
The king's chamber. Yeah. Now, that granite box, they've never found anything in it. The second pyramid at Giza, the middle pyramid that looks like the tallest pyramid, that's Khafre's pyramid. When Giovanni Belzoni opened the granite box in that chamber in 1818, it was still sealed. When he opened that box in 1818, it wasn't empty. What he found inside that box was a box filled with earth. Because what this was, it was a Chthonic earth ritual. It was about the rebirth of the kingdom of the earth, not of any king, not at that time anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, so that is why he found a box filled with earth. He thought it was some practical joke that someone had done in antiquity. But the thing is, Cliff, what we find later on, later dynasties of ancient Egyptian dynasties, you know, 11, 12, 13, they were making small stone boxes or wooden boxes sometimes, and they were filling it with earth and putting a lid on them and burying them in the ground and placing a large stone to symbolize a pyramid on top of this. You know, so they were making boxes themselves and filling them with earth. So doesn't that tell you, Cliff, that they knew what was in these big pyramids? The stone boxes and these big pyramids, the big stone boxes. It was the same thing. They were doing the very, very same thing. You know, it was only at this point it was more ritualistic. It was ceremonial, the smaller boxes. Just, you know, like I suppose, you know, nowadays some people would wear a small crucifix. You know, it's a ritual, it's ceremonial, and, you know, memory of the original cross. You know, so it's a similar idea. They knew what was in these pyramids, the stone boxes were filled with earth. The ancient Egyptians knew they were filled with earth, so they knew it and were doing the very same thing later. They were never for bodies. The ancient Egyptians have a name for these boxes filled with earth. They're called Nebank. They've got a different name for stone boxes filled with bodies. They're called Farsaw. And Egyptologists just give both of them the same name. They just call them sarcophagi. But they're not. A Quarsaw, which did contain a body, has the person's name and titles all over it and decorations. It's very decorated, a Quarsaw. But when you look at the stone granite boxes inside the Great Pyramid and Khafre's Pyramid, they're anonymous, completely anonymous. Not a single inscription on any of these granite boxes, because they weren't Quarsaw. They were Nebank. They were for containing earth. Nebank means container of life. That's what Nebank means. You know, and that's what it was about. It was about, you know, the rebirth of the earth. And that's the Egyptology history you won't find in the conventional books.
Before I let you go, thank you for that little piece there. I mean, for those of you who don't know Scott, Scott's an engineer with an extensive background in travel. And he's a great writer, too. Get these books. But I wanted to ask you, I've seen and heard from a number of different research people two things that makes that story possibly valid. One is that people, Chris Dunn, the engineer, did a study of the King's Chamber, and he believes that there was salt extracts on the walls, meaning that maybe the seawater got inside it. The other bit of information that I have from someone, and I can't remember what book it was, is that they actually found evidence of sea water, on the Great Pyramid, and all of the pyramids where the water level from a possible Great Flood actually hit the outer surface of the pyramid and left not only etching and erosion, but evidence of its being there. Have you heard about those?
Yeah. Yes, I have heard of those particular stories. I haven't researched them in any great depth, although I should have. One of them may have been written, in fact, by Herodotus. But I think the problem nowadays is that these sea marks were sea level marks were apparently on the outer casing stones of the pyramid, the white limestone casing stones, which are no longer there. They've all been they've all disappeared. Apparently, they fell off the pyramid in some 1800 during an earthquake or something like that, and the local people took them away to basically build Cairo. So all those casing stones that would have shown these marks, these tidal marks, if you like, have basically all disappeared. So what we have is just the core of the pyramid, the outer skin, if you like, which would have shown these marks, has disappeared.
Fascinating.
Unfortunately.
My guest today has been Scott Creighton, and it's the book's called The Great Pyramid Hoax. By the way, before I let you go, how's the weather in Glasgow, Scotland? I've never been there.
It's surprisingly, Cliff, it's very dark at the moment. It's very, yeah. It's been dark here since about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's now 20 past 6 in the evening. But it's very warm, strangely, very, very warm. There's actually some crocuses, small flowers that are actually budding like 2 months too early.
This has been going on for a couple of weeks warm, is what you're saying.
Probably for maybe about 7 or 8 days, something like that. But, in parts of the country, these flowers are coming up like a month or 2 months too early. So the world is changing.
That's amazing. Listen, much success on this new book. It's coming out on the 15th, it was a great read. I didn't read the whole thing, but it's very well documented. I would love to hear you in a panel discussion with Egyptologists just to talk about it, but of course we know that probably won't happen. We heard how Zahi Hawass reacts to people who oppose his opinion. I don't know. I hope in our lifetime that some of these this research can come to light and begin revising our history. So, Scott, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Cliff. It's once again, it's been an honor and a pleasure talking to you again.
Yes, I look forward to speaking to you in the future. And hey, have a great holiday, you and your wife. And
yeah, happy holidays to yourself and to all your listeners, too.
Thanks, Scott. Great to have you on. Thanks
again. Take care.
So that was Scott Creighton, and the book, The Great Pyramid Hoax, is out in just a few days. So a real fun read. And when I read and hear about these kind of things, you kind of wonder why these Egyptologists want to hold on to this information that is false. And here's a research investigator who's written a number of books on ancient Egypt, finding this evidence of this this SOB vice just hoaxing the whole thing. So fascinating idea. I want to remind you that this program is sponsored by Gaia, and the Gaia program, the Gaia special for Earth Ancient members, is just 99 cents. It's going on for the entire month. Go to Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients, and you can see a special page that's been presented for you, and you can learn about this entire catalog for just 99 cents. And if you don't like it, jump off. You don't need to stay with it. It's pretty cool, actually. Next week, my guest is Dr. Tom Vallone, and the subject is Nikola Tesla, Science from the Gods. He has discovered some amazing new evidence that Tesla may have tapped into ancient science, and also presents some new documentation of some secret machines that Tesla was working on that are out of this world. So that's on our program next week. Okay, I hope you have a great day, and we'll catch you next time.